welcome back to another week of the Alaska Identity Project. My name is Adrienne Lopez, broadcasting here on KTOO News Juneau, 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. Stay tuned in the next hour as I interview some interesting and exciting guests on the topic of oceans and our marine environment. In the first half hour, I'll be talking with Dave Gaudette, Marine Debris Program Coordinator for the Marine Conservation Alliance Foundation. And then the second part of the show, I'll be interviewing two guests from the organization Oceana, Chris Krenz, Arctic Project Manager, and John Warrenchuk, Ocean Scientist for Oceana's Pacific Region, based right here in Juneau. For more information about these organizations, remember to visit their websites, which is mcafoundation.org and na.oceana.org for the North American piece of Oceana. And if you're out there and you have questions for our guests, you can go on Facebook. You can find the Alaska Identity Project, like it on Facebook, and then write a question on the wall, or follow the program on Twitter at Alaska ID Project. And every week I put out tweets. If you're on Twitter, you can follow who the guests are every week. This week was Alaska Day on October 18th. I just thought I'd mention that because I was in a Rotary meeting and they announced the Club 49, which I thought was pretty cool. People can become a part of that if you're an Alaska resident, and I'll probably have one of the Alaska Airlines marketing guys on in the future to talk about that program. So, our first guest here, Dave Gaudette, is the Marine Debris Program Coordinator. He currently contracts with the Marine Conservation Alliance Foundation to manage their marine debris program and has worked with the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute and the Alaska Fisheries Development Foundation in their roles as client for the Alaska Salmon Fisheries in the Marine Stewardship Council Sustainable Management Certification Program. That's a mouthful. He has owned and operated a commercial salmon trawler and also participates in the Bristol Bay salmon fishery, as well as having worked for Fish and Game, Alaska Fish and Game, for many, many, many years. So welcome aboard, Dave.
Thank you, Adrienne.
Thanks for coming on. Hope we got a dog in the studio tonight. Let's just start out. I know that there's a bunch of different organizations involved. There's Marine Conservation Alliance as well as the foundation. So maybe just start out with some background and brief mission of what the organization's about.
Sure, that's correct. The Marine Conservation Alliance Foundation is the nonprofit arm of the Marine Conservation Alliance. And the Marine Conservation Alliance is a consortium of fishermen, fish processors, and communities that are involved in the North Pacific and Bering Sea crab and groundfish fisheries.
Okay.
It also includes the CDQ groups.
Right. Can you say what CDQ is for people who don't
community
know?
Community Development Quota.
Yeah. We talk in these here in Alaska. We say those things.
And so this group, the MCA, the parent organization, of course, their members are active on the water in the fisheries,
mm-hmm.
and they realized that marine debris was a problem, that it affected their livelihoods, and so they formed the foundation in 2003 to go ahead and try and address those problems.
Mm. And now the foundation's been in Alaska for a while. Or it's around the United States?
No. This is solely an Alaskan operation.
Okay.
Again, we're a group of, MCA is a group of North Pacific and Bering Sea processors and fishermen.
And
so it's a local Alaska group.
Okay. And the funding, we were talking about this earlier, this is state funded or federally? What is the
initial funding came from some of the MCA members themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the first project that they did was to work on St. Paul Island in the Pribilofs. After that, they started to seek out different sources of funding, and of course, the main source of funding has been the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
The main source came through the Marine Debris Prevention and Reduction Act, and began in 2006. And that money is something that's carried us along for several years. Recently, we've received a grant from the former Bureau of Mining and Management. Sorry, I can't remember their exact acronym, and they have a new name now. Anyhow, that will begin for us in the coming year, 2012. It's good for 2 years. We'll go through 2013. During that time, we hope that the Marine Debris Reduction Act, which is currently under reauthorization, gets passed and that there are some new opportunities to try and get some funds to continue working on marine debris.
Okay. So that would need to be passed by Congress then?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Hopefully that doesn't
pass by Congress and have some significant funding provided to it for cleanup activities.
Okay. Great. Now, your role is Marine Debris Program Coordinator. Can you just explain a little bit about your role before we go into this whole topic of what marine debris is? And
sure. My role is basically to oversee the program. Because we're what we do is we work with the local communities, and there's a good reason for that.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get out to these areas and find people to work on these programs, you're stuck. You got to go work with the local communities.
Yeah.
We're not going to be flying crews out. We have no employees. We don't have a crew that's sitting here in Juneau waiting to go find a hot spot of debris, and we fly them out there. That's not what we do.
Mm-hmm.
What we do is we solicit proposals once a year, and we work with a lot of these communities, and again with the CDQ groups, to find spots where there are known concentrations of marine debris. Again, the locals come in are real valuable in this process because they know where these deposits are, what beaches that are getting a lot of debris. So we work with them, and of course, we always get more proposals than we can fund.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things I do is I go through the proposals. I make sure that they're complete. I try and rank them as to a relative importance. We try and do cleanups where there's populations of seabirds, marine mammals, mm-hmm. anything that might be vulnerable to entanglement or any kind of damage from the marine debris. So once we... Once the board goes through all these recommendations and comes out with a list of projects, then I go ahead, I work with them to get to detail their exact operation, what they're going to do, where they're going to do, help them out. I've got some methods that I can work with them on. They might ask, how are we going to do this? How are we going to do that? And then I also work with them to try and write up a report.
Mm.
It's very important that we document what the debris is that's out there.
Yeah.
It's nice to know that we picked up 200,000 pounds, but it's a lot better to know we picked up 100,000 pounds of nets, 25,000 pounds of crab buoys, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so we've worked real hard to get a standardized reporting program, and you can see some of the reports that we've had from our contractors on our website. You can look and you can see
okay.
what kind of projects that they've done. Try to get lots of pictures because it's a spectacular thing to go watch. It's very intense trying to get some of this debris out of the surface, out of the subsurface.
Wow. Do things surprise you sometimes, just being out there?
I don't know if it surprises
yeah.
you after a while, but
I think
what probably does surprise you is some of the amounts that you find in some areas.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's lots of stuff out there. Now, just a follow-up question with the proposals. Is this something you're looking at yearly, or is it, I don't know, as you get proposals, the board decides on them?
No, it's an annual process.
Okay.
It doesn't have a fixed timeline. We've been, last year we got out our call for proposals in January. I suspect we'll probably be about the same again this year.
Mm-hmm.
So if anybody's interested, but I don't have a time, but you could call and find out, and we can put you on the list of when.
Okay. Some people
want to go about it.
Great. Now, let's go back a little bit and talk about what marine debris is for those out there who might be thinking, okay, is this garbage? What is it that you're finding? How do you define it? And why is it a problem? Why is there a need to clean all this up?
Sure. I'm just going to take the opportunity to read the definition because
okay,
I've never managed to memorize it myself.
No, it's okay.
And, you know, you can sort of go off on the tangents. So this is the definition they have. It's any anthropogenic, manufactured, or processed solid material, regardless of size, discarded, disposed of, or abandoned in the environment, including all materials discarded into the sea, on the shore, or brought indirectly to the sea by rivers, sewage, stormwater, and winds.
Wow.
So it's important to note that a lot of the marine debris is things that you might find far inland. A lot of the debris that we see is actually generated far upriver, makes its way down to the oceans, gets into the ocean, now it's marine debris. It started off as litter, becomes marine debris once it hits the ocean.
Mm. Like something we'll throw in our garbage dump could end up being marine debris, right?
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. And that's a problem in a lot of places. They do not have very good landfills, and it's a problem for Alaska, too.
Mm. In Alaska, it's different, right? We have different types of debris out there, or different way. Like you were telling me, if a plastic bag goes in the water, it's not as big of a problem as maybe a net, right?
Well, I don't know if it's not as big of a problem. It's just that, again, it's different when you compare the kind of marine debris that we have here in Alaska versus what you might read that was picked up off the beach in California or Oregon
mm-hmm.
or Washington. And number one, we have a much smaller population, so we're not actively, the Alaskans are not actively putting a lot of this debris into the water just because of our small population. One of the other things that affects us, though, greatly is the currents that are in the Pacific Ocean. Mm-hmm. We're on the subarctic gyre or the Alaska Current or whatever you would like to call it, but essentially travels from west to east across the Pacific and then hits the shoreline hits the North Coast shoreline, and it splits. There's a current that then goes down Washington, California, okay. Oregon, mm-hmm. and another one that goes British Columbia, Alaska, and then continues out along the Alaska Peninsula and then the Aleutians.
Okay.
There's also another current, of course, up in the Bering Sea that goes also from east to from west to east. And so we also get debris that comes over from Russia and then again goes along the Aleutians, then along the Alaska Peninsula, and then up through the Pribilofs and circulates around in that gyre.
Wow. So would you say Asia is giving us a lot of garbage?
Yes.
There's the most people over there.
Yes. Yeah. Asia is one of the sources. Anything, you know, a lot of the shipping, the bottles, we get a lot of plastic bottles. That's really one of the number one things that we see out there. Doesn't amount to a lot in weight, but there are a lot of plastic bottles, plastic water, plastic beverage,
yeah.
soda. And we get a lot of different languages. We've had Russian, Japanese, mm. Chinese, many, many, many different languages show up on those.
Wow. Fascinating. Now, what is the impact of this? I mean, there's marine debris out there. People might be like, so what? Just let it keep floating.
Right.
How is it affecting us as humans as well as the marine environment?
Well, there's several categories of impact. There's an ecological one. There's a economic one, the social impacts, and then also just the human safety in one. The one that we most see most often in Alaska, and one that actually sparked MCA to actually get interested in, is, of course, the damage that it does to animals, to sea life. You know, within the sea life, the number one thing that I think everybody's seen pictures of are the entangled birds, the entangled seals. And, you know, they run into a piece of discarded net. They may run into a tangle of line from, it could be anything from monofilament fishing line from sport fishing all the way up to a crab line that is all balled up. And oddly enough, one of the major sources of entanglement gear is just the plastic strapping that we see around boxes that's used very commonly in all the marine industries. In the fishing industry, the bait comes in boxes wrapped in that. The shipping industry, there's a lot of boxes that go across like that.
Yeah.
So that's one of the big things. You know, right now we've seen, of course, our entanglement data is all opportunistic, but there's been a lot of different species of seabirds, a lot of different species of mammals that have all been affected by this.
Yeah.
The second way that it affects animals, too, is by ingestion. A lot of this plastic breaks apart, breaks into very small pieces, and, you know, it's no surprise that the animals get fooled by it. Here in Juneau, we know all about that. We drag our plastic hoochies around behind our plastic flasher.
What's a hoochie?
A hoochie is for fishing for salmon.
Okay, I should know that.
The artificial squid, artificial octopus.
Okay.
So anyhow, you know, there's a lot of plastic out there. We typically fool fish with plastic lures.
That's true.
So we see these animals continually go after them, and it can either lead to suffocation. They may, normally they may get a piece of organic material, a fish or a plant or whatever, mm-hmm. and of course they can break it apart, chew it, and get it down. The plastic's not going to break apart, so it could suffocate them. Then once it could get into the stomach, it could be that they're small enough pieces. Well, then they can't get rid of it, and it accumulates in their stomach, and pretty soon you find these animals, they feel full, but there's no room in their stomach to get any nutrition in. So we have seen pictures of birds that have died on their nests where you see there's just plastic where their bodies were, where their stomach was.
That must break your heart.
Well, actually, I haven't seen too much of it since I'm always on the beach.
Okay.
The place that you see a lot more of that is the Midway Islands, Hawaiian islands, which are really heavily impacted by that.
Huh.
Another one that affects us, too, of course, is habitat destruction. Sometimes you get, it can affect coral reefs just because if you've got a line of some sort or a net of some sort going across, as it goes with the wave action, it's going to break off some of the coral. I've seen some photos that were from American Samoa last year where they had a tsunami down in American Samoa that actually took part of the landfill and deposited it back out in the sea.
No.
And they had pictures of coral reefs that were smothered by large pieces of tarp or anything that just went down and then just sat on top of them. So that was another one. And a couple of the other things is it's also thought to be a mechanism for the spreading of alien species. Again, you think about it, you've got a whole raft of something that's just out there floating. They got their own little community. They're all stuck onto the buoy. They may have started off in the tropics, and they come up here, and you gradually get something else.
Wow. Like, I heard there was a penguin one time up in Alaska from South America. But you're talking smaller.
Yeah.
Smaller
yeah.
species, huh?
Yeah. No, we haven't found any penguins on the beach.
Okay. That would be a sight. Now, the impact also is affected by the decomposition, right? Some of these things that we throw away, obviously we know, you know, there's a campaign here to not use plastic bags, and different forms of plastic don't break down. Do you guys deal with the different rates for what's faster breaking down?
We don't deal with the different rates. We're aware of them.
You're aware
of
them.
You know, so that sort of brings us to the point is marine debris wasn't a problem for my father. It wasn't a problem for my grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, one of the reasons was that marine debris really became a problem as plastics came in and those kind of containers. You know, prior to that, we had glass, which doesn't break down, but it's a natural natural element is, you know, sand. I mean, it may take a million years for that to break down. But where we get to real problems is things like monofilament line. It may take 600 years to disintegrate. These plastic beverage bottles that we see all over, it may take 450 years to get
wow.
rid of those. Aluminum cans are 80 to 200 years. Foam cups.
Styrofoam.
Foam is one of the worst. That's another one that animals love to go after once it breaks up, and it breaks up into just small pieces. Foam cups may take 50 years to break apart.
Wow. So, yeah, that gives us a little bit of perspective on what we use daily, right, in our lives. Now, you had mentioned a tsunami. Japan also had one recently, and you said that there was an impact with marine debris from that storm.
Yeah, that's correct. Japan had a very large earthquake.
And tsunami, of course.
And a resultant tsunami, I think it was March 11th of 2011
this year.
And there was a large amount of debris that went into the water. Of course, thanks to communication the way it is, we all saw pictures of the tremendous amounts of debris that were out there in the water. As it got into the currents, it started to disperse a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the question has always been, well, what's it going to do? And in Hawaii, at the University of Hawaii, there were two programmers who were working hard with computer models to try and predict where this large mass of debris was going to show up. There was some interesting news this last week in that there was a Russian training boat that reported that they went through a large amount of debris that they're absolutely certain is from the Japanese tsunami. And it's about... the good news was is it's right where the modelers had predicted it would be. In fact, it was right in the center of the dispersion that they had calculated. And it's about halfway between Japan and the Midway Islands right now. I looked around. There's a possibility that we're going to get some of this debris from the Japanese tsunami up here as it comes across on these currents. Mm-hmm. I looked around at some other articles recently to try and catch up on this. And there was an article... from one of the Oregon newspapers where the NOAA personnel down there had said that they could probably expect to see some debris offshore in as early as 2013. We expect that the first impacts will be again on the hard-hit Hawaiian islands, not the main islands of Oahu or Hawaii, the others. There's a whole lot of other atolls that are out farther to the north. But it looks like it's going to hit on those first as early as maybe spring this year.
Wow. Now, does Hawaii get a lot of marine debris?
Hawaii gets an exceptional amount of marine debris.
Yeah.
There was a large marine debris program out there. A lot of it is carried on, or a lot of the cleanup programs are carried out by National Marine Fisheries or NOAA staff out there because it occurs on atolls on which there is nobody living. So
atolls?
Coral reefs. They come up to the surface and other features that come up to the surface and maybe the top of a volcano that came up. And anyhow, they have to go out there with crews specifically to do that.
Mm.
I guess in one way we're lucky in that we do have a number of communities strategically placed throughout Alaska where we can work with some of those folks.
We can get that stuff. Now, I didn't ask this earlier, but what do you do with all the marine debris once you bring it ashore after you've cleaned it up? Where does it go?
Well, we don't bring it ashore. We only do shore-based programs.
Oh.
It would be nice. That would be a great dream would be to go out there and get it while it's actually floating in the waters. But trying to find it, trying to come up with methods, and anything you do working on the water is, of course, much more difficult, much more dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And so our program is really to get the stuff that's on the shore, to get it out of the ecosystem, get it before the plastic starts to break down, make sure it doesn't refloat. So what do we do with it? Well, that is one of our big problems.
Yeah.
It goes into landfills, into many of our poor Alaska landfills, many of them which are not designed to hold very much. We're working in villages of anywhere from 100 people to 500 people, and these people don't want that in their villages. Their attitude is that they didn't create it, and they don't want to put it into their landfill. And I don't know how much it costs to build a landfill, but I would imagine it's not an easy or an inexpensive project to do, to build a new landfill. So we do work with some communities, in particular St. Paul, the community of St. Paul on St. Paul Island.
Mm-hmm.
We have shipped all the debris off of there. Some of the other communities, we've shipped some of the debris, or we've shipped things that are somewhat recyclable.
Okay.
Out of their area. But a good one in point was a project at a village called Nelson Lagoon on the Bering Sea side of the Alaska Peninsula. I think their total population is 101. In their first year that we contracted with them, they picked up 88,000 pounds of marine debris. And they took it back to their village. And they dug pits. And after a while, they finally said, no, we can't do this anymore. We have to get some of this out of there. Interestingly enough, like so many Alaskan villages out there, they're built on very unstable ground. They're built on a sand spit.
Yeah.
And so at some point, it's very likely to become a problem again.
And then go back
there.
In.
Yeah.
So 88,000 pounds for 100 people, that's like way more than you'd ever generate in your lifetime, right? I mean, how many pounds does
someone generate? I don't know about that.
Generate,
I mean,
of
you
trash.
Think about, you know, what modern packaging has done to us, which is, of course, a lot of the problem that we have. And why we have so much marine debris, I don't know what the statistics are, but I would think we probably generate quite a bit of trash in our lifetime individually.
Yeah, especially
hopefully
in the developed world,
the environment.
Even more when we live in countries of states or Europe, right? But we can reduce our footprint. Now, in the time we have left, I wanted to go over a few of the projects you have, because I know you guys have stuff all over Alaska. And maybe just highlight a few key places, and then also this coastal code that you're working with volunteers in.
Sure. We started in 2003, and it started out in the Pribilofs.
Okay.
And why the Pribilofs? Well, number one, they have the Pribilof Islands are best known for the large populations of the northern fur seal. It was a fur seal that was hunted commercially up until the mid-80s, somewhere in that area. And the population is again declining, despite the fact that there is no more commercial sealing on that. They were noted for having entanglements. It seemed like a real good place. These people did not want the marine debris on their beaches. And also there's a lot of marine debris up there and in the North Pacific, primarily because of some of the old historic fishing. We had a lot of foreign fleets. There were up to 600 Russian trawlers off the coast on an annual basis,
wow.
400 Japanese up until the passage of the Mangusen Act in 1976. So anyhow, we started off in the Bering Sea. We started off on St. Paul, and we worked there for a couple of years. We expanded out a little bit more. We went over to St. George Island, which has the second largest of the Pribilofs, obviously has the second largest population of northern fur seals. And so we were interested in that. Then we began to spread out. Both of those places do have a significant amount of debris, and we make a real effort to try and clean up in the areas where the fur seals are using it to try and prevent entanglements as much as we can. Then we started to spread out a little bit more. We went out to Prince William Sound.
That's
Prince William
my
Sound.
Hometown.
Prince William Sound?
Valdez,
oh,
yeah.
Valdez, okay.
Shout out to people listening. No. If there are any.
Well, Prince William Sound is sort of uniquely located We looked at some storm data this year, and most of the winds that come across the Pacific on our side come out of the south. Those are where we get our really big storms. And up at the northern end of Prince William Sound, on the outer Montague Islands, the Kenai Peninsula, is where it starts to curve around, so pretty soon they're perpendicular to the storm line, so everything's really being deposited up there. Plus, there's some strong currents up there that are also depositing. To date, the largest deposit of marine debris has come from that area. It's come from a place called Gore Point. And it's too bad that we can't show the audience some pictures of what they found the first time they were out there. But again, the winds in these areas are horrific. They found debris back several hundred yards, buoys, large pieces of styrofoam, all just blown through the trees, blown way back. So you're not cleaning just on the beach anymore. So much of this just rolls far, far back.
So it's the largest deposit. Could you guys weigh how much it was? Do you have an idea?
Yeah. They took about 80,000 pounds out from a very small area. When I talked about Nelson Lagoon, they took 88,000 pounds out. But that was over about, I think it was 20 miles of beach that they cleaned. They're lucky enough there that they get in their trucks and drive down the beach and clean a lot of area. The Gore Point area was probably only a half mile or maybe something like that. So it's much more dense, and again, we have some pictures on our website that it's incredible. It's an incredible deposit of marine debris out there. From there, we moved in a little bit to southeast. We got down to Yakutat, and of course, the beaches for Yakutat, there was a lot of things showing up there, and that's where we met up with the Coastal Code.
Okay.
And, of course, I guess folks who listen know all about the Coastal Code.
Well, last week Alaskan Brewing just highlighted it as part of their social responsibility, but you might want to briefly mention it again.
Sure. What they do is they donate 1% of all the sales of the IPA beer to what they call the Coastal Code. And then what they do is they do various projects trying to give back to the ocean. They're all involved with ocean projects. Mm-hmm. We were lucky enough to partner with them to get some money to do the Yakutat cleanup. So they actually pay for a portion of the Yakutat cleanup. They're very interested in it. Plus, they have used it as a well, they've done several things. They have brought people from outside of Alaska in as sort of a contest. The first year that I went with them, they had a contest where what do you and your organization do for the oceans? And then the people in 250 words or less wrote about it, and they brought up three people from California and one person from Anchorage, and of course, we don't make them work all day long. They took some time out to surf, which of course Yakutat is famous for, and thanks to the kind people at Alaska Brewery, they also brought along a lot of their products for all the
very nice for the night activities.
Right, so they've been a very important partner, and we're very happy to work with them. They've also been very big on International Coastal Cleanup Day right here in Juneau. One of your guests, Ashley, has worked a lot to do a lot of the planning to make sure that that project comes off smoothly each September.
Wow. Wow. So any other projects you wanted to highlight? We don't have a whole lot of time. I was hoping you could mention how if people, you can contribute on the website by saying, hey, I see garbage in this area. You should consider it.
Sure. Yeah, you can give us a call.
Get involved. Okay.
Yeah, you can give us a call, or my email address is available through there.
Okay.
So either way would work. You can send us an email, or you can go ahead and give us a call. There's no shortage of marine debris out there. We've barely scratched the surface. We find ourselves going back to the same areas because there's reaccumulation as a lot of this debris continues to come out of the water. We think a lot of it is legacy gear that was dumped maybe many, many, many years ago and cleans up. But out of Alaska's 33,000 miles of coastline, we've done a very small portion of it.
33,000 miles of coastline. I should know that, right? So how many miles of coastline do you think you've impacted with all these projects?
Oh, we've maybe done, thanks to projects like Nelson Lagoon, where we can get out on some beaches, and again, like Yakutat, where you can get on some sandy beaches and get some miles. I haven't totaled it up, but I guess we haven't done any more than 150 to 200 miles.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, these projects.
Sure. I mean, these projects are very labor intensive.
Yeah.
You're getting out and you're walking. The debris is not easy to get out. Mm. We always get kidded about how lucky we are to just go beachcombing all the time. It is a hard work walking across some of these beaches and digging for a long time, to pull out the tangles of nets, called tangles of lines and other things like that, that are buried in the sand or whatever, or wrapped around tree after tree after tree, and trying to just cut with knives to free all it and get it off. So so we don't get very far on each one.
But
we keep trying.
Yeah. Is there anything valuable you found, anything interesting that you've kept, taken home with you?
I think the most valuable thing that I've heard of being found was that our contractor in Kodiak came up with a case of Suntory whiskey.
Okay.
I wish I had been in that case. I missed that one.
Wow. Well, I'd love to have some right now. No, just kidding. We are going to finish up here with the website. Your website is mcafoundation.org.
That is correct.
Yeah, let me read it again. So if you're interested and you're out there and you want to get involved, you can volunteer, or you can also report marine debris or write to Dave Gaudet here, who is Marine Debris Program Coordinator for the Marine Conservation Alliance Foundation. So thanks again, Dave, for coming on.
You're welcome.
And enlightening everyone out there about what you're doing. Keep
up
the good
work.
Thanks again. We'll be back on in the next half hour with Chris Krenz and John Warrenchuk, who work for Oceana. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Alaska Identity Project. My name is Adrienne Lopez here on KTO News Juneau in Alaska's capital city. We were listening to Willie and Lobo, a little relaxing music there in between our guests. We had in the first hour Dave Gaudette, who is the Marine Debris Program Coordinator for the Marine Conservation Alliance Foundation here in Juneau and throughout Alaska. Really doing a lot of good work with marine debris. If you're interested in knowing more about some of the work they do, you can go to the mcafoundation.org on the website and, of course, report marine debris and get involved in some of their campaigns they have in Alaska. And back in this half hour, we're also kind of sticking with this ocean theme and marine, which is what Alaska is really about, right? That's what we care about, is John and Chris. And I'll give a little bit of background on you guys here. John Warrenchuk is the ocean scientist for Oceania's Pacific region and is based in Juneau, Alaska. He has studied the Alaskan marine ecosystem for more than 15 years, including journeys to the bottom of the sea in submarines, wow, and time on a Bering Sea commercial crab boat. He holds a master's degree or a bachelor's degree in ecology from the University of Calgary and a master's of science in fisheries from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Dr. Chris Krenz is the Arctic Project Manager for Oceania and is based out of Juneau as well. He works to sustain vibrant Arctic ecosystems, including subsistence activities from rapid climate change, ocean acidification, and the expansion of industrial activities. Chris is responsible for coordinating Oceania's Arctic work and helps lead science and policy efforts. Thanks for coming on, guys, to the
show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah. You guys have a lot of radio interviews around Alaska?
Oh, from time to time we talk about our work, usually associated with one action by our government or another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, I found you on YouTube the other day, Chris. I was looking for Juneau videos, and you were on a timberland campaign that they were working on, Juneau to Chile kind of a thing.
Yeah, out by the Mendenhall Glacier, and we were talking about some of the Arctic issues we'll be talking about tonight as well.
Oh, great, yeah. So you can find Chris on the Internet, Google him. What else can you find? Well, let's just start with some background on Oceania. You know, it's good to know what kind of organization you are both working for, and then the roles that you both play in this organization.
Well, Oceania is an international ocean conservation organization, and we have offices in South America, in Europe, Central America, and here in the U.S. In the U.S., we have where the organization is headquartered in Washington, D.C. We have a couple offices on the West Coast, and then we lead our Pacific work out of our Juneau office here, here in this town.
Nice.
Basically, our mission statement is to protect the world's oceans, and it's a nonprofit organization, and we have what we call our wave makers, the people that both support us and then weigh in on different policy advocacy work that we're doing, and we have about 500,000 wave makers worldwide.
Wow. You know, people might know the organization better because Ted Danson, is he the head or the president or started it?
Ted Danson is one of our board members.
Okay.
And he helped found Oceania. He was working on with a different organization that was merged into Oceania back about a little over 10 years ago. And we've had an office here in Juneau for about 10 years. So
10 years.
Shortly after the organization was founded, they established an office here in Juneau.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's a great bunch of people to work with. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And it's great to work with a lot of like-minded people on things that make a difference.
Mm. Do people come from all over to work at this office, different offices of Oceania?
Well, they come from varied backgrounds. You know, they're drafted from various...
drafted?
As our boss likes to say, he thinks he drafts well. So it's,
good.
It's a good team, and love working for him.
Nice. So 10 years in Alaska, what just kind of highlight the issues that you're working on here? And then, of course, we'll get into some Arctic stuff later. But
well, John has worked for over 7 years, I guess, with Oceania here in Juneau.
8 years now.
Eight years now. So you're probably better suited than my 5 years to talk about it.
Well, we've worked on a lot of different issues through the years at Oceania. Some of the early issues had to do with cruise ship pollution. Protecting habitat, particularly from destructive fishing gears like bottom trawling. We work on promoting sustainable fisheries, primarily concerned with the industrial fisheries of the Bering Sea and Gulf of Alaska. What else?
Yeah, well, let's stop on the trawling, because I was just looking at your video online, and it talked about some legislation you worked on a few years ago to stop bottom trawling, or?
Sure. Well, bottom trawling is far from being stopped here in Alaska.
Explain what it is, too, because that might be good for
trawling is, you know, Alaska's a fishing state. You know, fisheries is a big part of Alaska, and fisheries is one of the, in fact, if not the biggest private employer. But most fishermen in Alaska are salmon fishermen or halibut fishermen. But most of the fish in Alaska are caught with trawls. And this is the practice of using generally large boats and dragging a net along the seafloor to catch as much fish as possible at once. And these large boats, some of them up to 350 feet long, with nets the length of a football field, can catch 40 to 100 tons of fish at a time.
Wow.
And our beef with it is that when it's used as bottom trawling, giant steel doors scrape along the bottom, and the net itself, either with chains or rubber roller wheels, just kind of bounce along and flatten and crush a lot of things in its path. So it's a pretty non-selective fishing technique, and you catch a lot of things that you're not intending to catch. And it's a fishing technique we'd like to see transition to cleaner fishing gears.
And so, what was your role in the legislation? Was there something passed?
Well, we strongly encouraged, I'd say.
Okay, strongly.
The Fishery Service and the Fishery Management Council to set aside a lot of areas that hadn't been trawled yet. You know, the first pass of one of these trawl nets is the most damaging. So Alaska is actually, we're lucky that we don't have hundreds and hundreds of years of these kind of fisheries. You know, they've only sprung up in the last 50 or 60 years. So there's still a lot of places in Alaska that hadn't been flattened by trawls. And so we helped convince the government and the Fisheries Management Council to set aside a lot of the area that hadn't yet been trawled.
Okay.
And this protected hundreds of thousands of square miles of habitat in the Aleutian Islands, seamounts, which are underwater mountains in the Gulf of Alaska, and the far north, north of Nunavak Island in the Bering Sea.
Mm-hmm. Now, Chris, people say the oceans are in crisis. Do you think up here in Alaska we're having the same situation? Is it a crisis situation here?
Well, I think up in Alaska we are lucky that we haven't necessarily fished with these big industrial fleets for as long.
Yeah.
And we've the North Pacific Fishery Management Council has done a better job than other councils and other fishery management organizations around the world at recognizing that fishing can have a really big impact on the oceans, they still have a ways to go. And Oceana and a lot of the work that John is talking about is encouraging them to continue on that path towards sustainability. And just taking a step back, Oceana isn't about saying no to things. We're really in the business of trying to figure out what is a sustainable pathway forward. How can we go out fishing, get fish, eat fish, but still make sure that we have a healthy ecosystem so that there'll be fish tomorrow to catch too.
Exactly.
And we try and bring that in general. There are a lot of big changes occurring in our ocean environment. In the Arctic in particular, climate change is a really big impact. This year, the sea ice cover in the Arctic was near the record low or just below the record low, depending on which sensor and algorithm for calculating sea ice cover one looked at. I think even scarier is that happened with pretty normal weather conditions in the Arctic, whereas in 2007, when what was the previous record, we actually had some really extreme weather that led to a lot of sea ice cover loss. And then the other big concern is that volume-wise, we've actually lost in September, if you look at the average amount of sea ice in September, we've lost about two-thirds of the sea ice.
Two-thirds.
There's only about one-third of the volume of sea ice, as best as scientists can figure out, left in the Arctic Ocean. So this is a pretty big impact, and
wow.
So we're seeing some really big changes in that region. And that, in addition, is opening the region to an expansion of industrial activities, and a lot of focus and a lot of the debate these days is on oil and gas activities.
Mm. Is that a debate, you think, about further exploration?
Well, I'd say it's a contentious debate,
uh-huh.
to say the least. That, and really, pretty much any decision that's going to be made right now is going to be contentious, and it's ending up in the courts. And we got to really figure out what's a way that we can get the debate out of the courts and back into the decision makers' hands, and in such a way that we can reduce the conflict over a lot of these resources,
mm-hmm.
and figure out a good pathway forward, and do it in a way where all the stakeholders are really involved in the decision-making process, so that people can come to some level of agreement on that.
Yeah, and there's a lot of countries involved in this, right, that are involved in Arctic issues or border the Arctic?
Certainly, and it's a circumpolar Arctic, and there's five coastal nations, and then the Arctic Council, which has eight different nations represented at it, as well as five different indigenous permanent participants that are also part mm-hmm. of the Arctic Council. And so that's sort of, it's not a governing body, but it's where the high-level international discussions occur. But a lot of the policy is still driven by the individual countries within their own territorial waters, which mm-hmm. take up much of the Arctic. There's still somewhat of a donut hole, so to speak, in the middle, and all, but that's still the area that's covered with quite a bit of ice, sea ice.
Mm. Do you think it's going to be easy to come to consensus with some of these different stakeholders that are involved?
I think it's the way it's going. That's the real challenge. And how do we move from this state where everything is going to the courts to be decided to actually bring it back to people? And I think that there are a lot of opportunities out there to actually figure out a way to sit down at the table and approach this comprehensively. And I think one of the real big problems that we're having now is that each individual decision is happening permit by permit with no big vision and no big discussion about how we're going to move forward as a whole mm-hmm. in the region. And mm-hmm. until we sit down and have that big discussion and figure out, is there what information do we need to know about the region in order to make wise decisions about if we should be drilling in that region, and
yeah.
if so, when, where, and how. And then we really need to get to a place where we admit, look, if there's an oil spill there, we just can't deal with it. If there's a really big oil spill like there was in the Gulf of Mexico, if you have that in the Arctic, we're just not going to be able to deal with it. These claims that we can clean up 95% of the oil by industry, it's ludicrous.
Mm.
And if you actually look at the number of days that you can be out on the water, it's something like 3 out of every 5 days, depending on
the
time of the year. You won't even, you can get out. So there's a couple days a week that you're not even able to go out and do things. And so we just need to come to that realization and just be truthful. And then if using that really honest, open discussion, we decide we have to move forward, then figuring out how to do it in a good way. And one of the projects we're really working on in that regard is to identify important ecological areas in the region, which are
IEAs, right?
IEAs is what we call them. And they're basically, we know when we go out fishing, and you're from a fishing family, as I heard, and we go to particular places to go fishing. We know the ocean is not a uniform place, that some places are better for fishing, some places are better for hunting than other places. And we really need to understand how the ocean varies from place to place so that the really important areas that are important for maintaining the health of the ocean, we can really take extra precaution to make sure those areas are maintained in the long term.
Excellent. Now, you go out to the Arctic. You go out to these areas, right, Chris? That's part of your job, to travel there.
Yes.
Oceania.
I've been up to the Arctic probably about 15 times this year so far. I've been to a number of different coastal communities, mm-hmm. and I've been to some of the regional hubs a number of times, such as Kotzebue and Barrow, but been out to Point Hope and Point Lay and Wainwright and other smaller communities.
And so you're working with these local communities as well with Oceana. Have you incorporated some of this kind of dialogue with them into your work?
Yeah, one of the things that we're trying to do with the important ecological areas work is really just figure out where those areas are to begin with. And the idea is if we know where those areas are, we can move management forward in a way that helps protect those areas,
mm-hmm.
and make sure that basically the pillars of the health of the ecosystem are maintained. And so we've gone and told communities about this project, and if there's support within the communities, we will work with them to incorporate their local and traditional knowledge into our work to identify these areas. The people that go out hunting there on a day-to-day basis, they just know an incredible amount. And so if you're looking at something like walrus, for example, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has gone out and counted walrus a handful of times, really only about two times where they really try to go out and count the number of walrus that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so they might document in those two different trips out there that there's a walrus haul out at a specific location. But that's only twice that they've been there.
Mm.
I trust the hunters that go out there almost on a daily basis to tell me, well, how many walrus are there usually in that spot? And where do they go to feed? Or do you know where they go to feed? And they have an incredible amount of information to offer. And really the best available information for figuring out where these important areas are is the local and traditional knowledge of the people along with the Western scientific information.
Of course, they have to complement each other. Do you see some of these communities concerned? I'll get to you in a second, John. We'll switch on and off. Are these communities concerned? Are they aware of what's happening? I guess they see it directly in their environment, right?
Oh, certainly. I mean, the discussions going on within the communities, within these regional places on some of these issues like oil and gas, and other issues are a really big issue. Shipping in the Bering Strait, these are really big issues that people in little communities of a few hundred people are discussing vigorously.
Mm.
And just like any community, there's a lot of variability within the community on what people think.
Yeah.
Oceana tries to approach communities in a more holistic way, whereas the community generally. And even from community to community, you see a lot of difference in what people are interested in seeing happen, at least in the discussions I've had with people there. And a lot depends on how much risk they feel their community is undertaking and how much benefits that they potentially may receive from future development.
Interesting. Huh. Wow, interesting role you have out there.
It's just been spectacular to go up there and to see these regions and to really the opportunity to get to talk to some of these people out there that really, I mean, they're real Alaskans. They're out there, they're hunting. They're great
stories.
I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's just incredible to talk with these people. Yeah.
And Chris comes back to the office and tells us his ventures, riding snowmobiles through the ice to visit the whalers out on the edge as they haul a bowhead up on the ice.
Wow.
Blubber.
The
looking out for polar bears.
The migration in the spring, along the Chukchi Sea coast as all these animals go up to the Arctic to feed for the summer. Is just incredible. I mean, I haven't been to the Serengeti, but you hear about these massive animal migrations, and this has got to parallel it, at least in some respects. I mean, you have tens of thousands of sea ducks flying by along this ice edge lead, this area of open water where that's next to the shore fast ice, the ice that clings to the shore. And they're just flying over in clouds. And then there's all these whales going by and all these ice seals and everything. It's
just
spectacularly gorgeous because you're out on ice is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And ice next to water is even more beautiful. I mean, we're blessed with Mendenhall Glacier here in Juneau. We understand that. And to put those things and then just fill it with wildlife, It's incredible.
And I think a lot of people in Alaska, we don't get the chance to go to these places just because it's so expensive. I mean, when you grow up here, you end up staying in your community or in Southeast, but to go to the real Alaska, which is a lot of these rural areas, is hard to get to. So,
well, that's not to say that it's not real Alaska down here.
It's real Alaska.
We go to Fred Meyer to get our food often, right?
Or wherever, Costco,
or whatever in town. They're going to the grocery store outside their door a lot. And I think a lot of people in Southeast Alaska do that too. And I love Southeast Alaska. It's beautiful as well.
But John. Now, our state is resource development, right? We have a lot of resource utilization, oil and gas, mining, et cetera. And we also talk about conservation and the importance of this. Do you think those two are opposed to each other? How does Oceana view this kind of conservation approach?
Well, fishing and fisheries is probably the best example of how we can utilize a resource sustainably.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have some good examples of sustainable fisheries. Many of our salmon fisheries, you know, are world-class in sustainability. You know, Alaska's invested in salmon, you know, protecting salmon habitat. You know, we haven't clear-cut all the forests right up to the streams like, you know, our neighbors to the south in British Columbia have. And who have now invested in fish farms instead. And you probably have heard about what they've unleashed on our coast now with a wild salmon virus that's, you know, escaped from the fish farm and into the wild population.
From someone, the sockeye runs on the Fraser.
So, yeah, so how to do it wrong is what they're doing down south in Canada. But we're doing a lot of things right up here in Alaska. But we still have a lot of work to do with these industrial groundfish fisheries.
Okay.
Now, the federal government calls pretty much every fish other than salmon or crab or halibut groundfish, and that's a good name for it because essentially most of them are ground up into fish sticks. And
did you think of that?
No, that's that might be the etymology of it. I'm not sure, but you know, at some point along the development of this resource, people decided that huge volumes were what was good for the industry and for the fishery. And I don't think that's necessarily the case. You know, I think you can take smaller amounts of fish, high quality fish, and still provide a lot of jobs and still have it be good for the resource. Right now, the actual management goal of a lot of these fisheries is to reduce the population of fish down to 40% or 30% of what used to be there. That's not a lot of fish left, you know, and that is what a lot of scientists guess at is the most productive point of the stock. So if you outcompete everything else that eats the fish, like the sea lions, like other fish, like whales and fur seals, then sure the you can catch more fish, but you also start to change the ecosystem a lot.
Yeah,
and we're starting to figure out that well you can't change the ecosystem that much without some pretty big impacts on everything else, and we'd like to kind of move it back in the other direction. So we're not saying stop fishing, but we are saying for a lot of the fisheries, we're going to have to slow down a bit, leave a little more in the ocean.
Yeah, and you guys are contributing. Oceana's helping, right?
Trying to.
Making an impact. Now, we only have a couple seconds left. If people want to get involved, they can go on your website. If you're here in Juneau, is there something you could stop by your office to get more information?
Absolutely. We're up in the old tenant building on the fourth floor, and we'd love it if people stop by and happy to talk to folks. You know, we occasionally get a few cruise ship passengers that stop in, and we'd much rather get the folks from town come in and chat with you.
Or visit us on the web.
On the web.
Or visit us on the web if you don't want to come downtown.
You can become a wave maker, right?
Exactly. That would be great.
Oh, nice. Well, thank you both. We have John Warrenchuk, he's an ocean scientist, as well as Chris Krenz, who's Arctic Project Manager for Oceana, international organization with a big presence here in Alaska. So thanks for coming on
tonight. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Good luck with your efforts. And I will thank the studio engineers. I always forget. We've got Martha and Susan, who have come every week to help the Alaska Identity Project be a reality. So thanks for listening. And we'll see you next week with Ray Troll.